Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 20, delivered on November 9, 2015. The title of this lecture is Cost of Capital.
Today, the cost of capital. As we wind down the course, this is the last week of new material, and I'm sure you are sad about that. We cover chapter 13 today and then and on Wednesday, and then next week we review and then take exam 2. So it's important, by the way, because there's content in here that is definitely bait for questions on exam, on in-class exam 2. So we begin. The first part of this is the components of capital. The components of capital. There are actually two broad categories of capital. There's debt, and then there's equity. Now, on the debt side, there's long-term debt and short-term debt. This focuses primarily on the long-term debt, but don't forget the debt also includes short-term borrowings as well, commercial paper and other short-term instruments. Equity includes preferred stock and common stock. Okay, so there's short-term debt, and then there's long-term debt. And on the equity side, there's preferred stock, preferred, and then there is common. But there's another way to break this down, another way, in terms of equity. And it's kind of important to understand this other way. Another way that you could look at equity is to say that there is internally generated equity, and then there is externally generated equity. In other words, a company can raise equity capital by either selling stock, preferred or common, whatever, but it can also generate equity by selling its product and making a profit. That's an important thing to understand, is that we focus so much on, in a course like this, on IPOs and offerings and selling debt instruments. But the primary way that a company survives over a long period of time is not by how much debt it sells, short-term or long-term, not by how much preferred and common stock it sells, but by actually building things that make money at the bottom line. If it can't do that in the long run, it fails. However, internally generated equity has this one defect in it. It happens slowly over time. Oftentimes, it takes years to build up a strong free cash flow pattern. And you have to have lots of money right up front to get things started or for a new project. That's where these other instruments of equity and debt come in, that they can put that big chunk of money right there on the front end so that you can get things started, so that the internally generated equity starts happening and keeps happening. But again, in the long run, the company has got to make internally generated equity, in other words, making money at the bottom line for its shareholders, if it wants to survive. And you remember there are two things that it can do with that money that it generates for the shareholders. It can issue it as dividends, or it can plow it back and cause the company to grow. Always keep that in mind. Know this. At first pass, debt is a cheaper source of capital than equity. Debt is cheaper than equity, at least at first. There are two reasons for this. The first reason is that the debt holders will not expect as much because they get the first claim on cash flows. So they know they're going to get their money first, and if the company goes tap city, they're going to liquidate the company and get whatever comes out of that. And the equity holders are going to be left holding the bag. That's why the equity holders are going to expect a higher return on their investment, because they are more at risk than the debt holders. So debt is going to be cheaper than equity simply because debt has prior claim on the cash flows. Do listen carefully here, because this is a great kind of question for an essay. There is a second reason, however, that debt is cheaper than equity to the company. You see, when I issue a dividend happens, I've got my earnings before interest and taxes, minus my tax, minus my interest. This is operating income, by the way, EBIT. Don't ever forget, EBIT is just another way of saying operating income. Minus my interest expense. And that gives me my earnings before taxes, minus my taxes. And that gives me my net income. Any dividend that the company pays is paid after the net income line. In other words, the company has already paid tax on the money before it can pay a dividend out. From the shareholder's perspective, this kind of sucks, because the shareholder is getting a dividend that will be taxed as income to the shareholder. And the company's already been taxed on the money to begin with, so you have double taxation going on. Yeah, that's not good. From the company's perspective, though, there's something else going on here. Its interest that it pays on its debt is deducted before taxes are calculated. So in other words, the company actually doesn't pay a tax rate, doesn't pay, say, 8% on its debt, coupon of 8%. It doesn't pay 8%. It pays 8% times 1 minus the corporate tax rate. So in other words, the after-tax cost of debt is actually the cost of debt times 1 minus the marginal tax rate. That symbol there is tau, the Greek letter tau. It represents marginal tax rate. That's what the company actually pays. So if, for example, let's say that the company's marginal tax rate is 25%. It issues debt at an 8% coupon. The company actually does not pay 8%. It pays 8% times 1 minus the company's marginal tax rate. So this company's after-tax cost of debt is 6%. Nothing like that happens with equity. The cost of equity is the cost of equity, right there in your face. But debt gets that little push from our tax code. I want you to think about this for a second. This is something that applies to both corporations and households. We have a progressive tax system. In other words, the more you make, the higher your margin, the rate is on the last dollar that you make. Okay, now, let's put it in terms of my company and some giant mega company. My company's tax rate is 15%. Megacorp International might have a corporate tax rate approaching 40%, marginal tax rate. Okay, so let's say that we both go to the bank and we both get 10%. My little company and Megacorp. R sub D and R sub D. the very same cost of debt after tax for me would be 10% times 1 minus 0.15. For Megacorp, it would be 10% times 1 minus 0.40. So, my after-tax cost of debt is 8.5%. That son of a bitch corporation that is giant pays an after-tax cost of debt of 6%. In other words, our tax code favors debt the larger the corporation is. This applies to people as well. If you are a wealthy person in a high marginal tax bracket, suppose that you are rich. Your marginal tax rate, let's say, is 35%. You, on the other hand, things never worked out for you. You know, eventually you got an assistant manager job at Denny's, third shift, but still, it's a living. So your tax rate, let's say it's overall about 10%. You both go to the bank and you get yourself a loan on a house for 5%. The rich person's after-tax cost of debt, because mortgage interest is tax deductible, is 5% times 1 minus 0.35. Yours, the poor person, working poor, is 5% times 1 minus 0.10. Our tax system favors home ownership for the wealthy. And we are seeing that becoming stronger and stronger. I showed you the graph, but it is becoming a more and more pronounced effect that this is that home ownership, borrowing money to have a nice home, that is something for the rich, not the poor. Because the rich get a much lower, considerably lower, after-tax cost of mortgages than the poor do. In fact, probably a low-income person wouldn't even try to deduct the mortgage on the mortgage interest on a home loan. The rich person is, of course, going to do that every time. So lo and behold, we have a tax system because of its progressivity and because of the tax deductibility of interest. We have a system that favors leverage debt for large corporations and wealthy households differentially from what it does for small corporations and low-income households. That's an important feature of our system, and it is explaining in quite a bit of measure why we see home ownership among the lower 80% of households in the United States plummeting over the especially over the past 10 years or so. It's just been dropping like a rock. There you go. So keep that in mind, that when I talk about the cost of capital, debt is going to be cheaper than equity, because first, debt is less risky than equity because the lenders get prior claim on cash flows. And it's cheaper than equity because the interest is tax deductible. Equity has neither of those features. It's expensive. Now, when I say expensive, what are the numbers we're talking about? I don't know, maybe one like this. You're talking about debt costs, after-tax debt cost to a corporation, maybe in the range of 6%. That would not be a shocking number for a regular, normal kind of corporation, the after-tax cost of debt. What are we talking about for the cost of equity? Oh, God. I mean, the after-tax cost of equity, you're talking about numbers that can be 20, 25%. I mean, the cost is, and it's even worse. I want to tell you something. Interestingly enough, the book doesn't push this, talk about this too much. But interestingly enough, the cost of externally generated equity is higher than the cost of internally generated equity. The reason that happens, I'm going to write the cost of equity. This is just an algebraic manipulation of a formula I showed you before. But the cost of equity is the dividend one period out over the price of the equity, the current, this is market, by the way, this isn't book, this is market, over the market price of the equity plus the growth rate of the dividend. That's the cost of equity. That's the cost of equity. Now, you notice if it's preferred equity, the D is the same. It's not D1 or D0. It's the same. And the G is 0. So with common, I could write this a little more verbosely. It would be the cost of common is D0 times 1 plus G over P0 plus G. Okay? And the cost of preferred R sub P would be just D over P0. These are just algebraic manipulations, and I'll do that in the next class. I'll just show you the formulas that I had shown you earlier in the course and just twist them around. And those are your component equity cost, cost of capital. Don't sweat that for now. We'll just do a couple of examples in the next one. Go ahead. This one, this is just the general formula for the cost of equity. Okay, so if I'm talking about common equity, D1 is D0 plus 1 times 1 plus G. Remember, it's not the current dividend, it's the dividend one period out. Remember that? That's the one that'll trip you up. The thing, though, is that if it's a preferred stock, the dividend is the same forever. So there's really no D1, D0. It's just a dividend that you get the same one. Remember, it's on the your dividend is 1.5% of the par value, $40 a share. So the dividend is always the same. And it doesn't grow, the dividend doesn't, so that G drops off. So the cost of preferred equity is a simpler formula. Again, don't sweat. I'll go pass by this again on Wednesday. The one thing that I do want to point out, though, here's what I'm trying to get at here on this little pass. Internally generated equity, technically, this is exactly right for the cost of internally generated equity. But with externally generated equity, the price that you would use isn't the price of the stock. It would be the price of the stock minus the brokering fees to sell the stock. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that when you're calculating the cost of common equity, you would divide by the market price of the stock. But if you were selling new stock, the company's not going to get the price of the stock. It's going to get the price of the stock minus a flotation cost. Now, back in the day, there are limits on how much those investment banks can charge. So, like, for example, the current price of the stock is $50 a share. So this investment bank syndicate sells 10 million shares of it. The company is not going to get $50 for each share it sells. It'll get $50 minus the brokering fees, the flotation costs. Could be 8%, 10%. You know, brokering fees for commissions, legal fees, consulting fees, you name it. So that denominator, if it's new equity, is going to be smaller than if you're talking about stock that's already out there floating around. Give you an example of how severe this can be. The difference between what the market price of stock is and what a company would get if it sells more of the stock. Some years back when I was in consulting, one of the things we would do is help companies get funding to go public. We went, there was this one really strange gig. These two young hotshot Momo boys and I, we went to a back lot at the airport in Atlanta where there were all these trailers where these little companies, transit companies and delivery companies had their little offices. And there was one trailer there where a guy was trying to set up a new company. He was going to buy up these old Lufthansa jets, gut the seats out of them and turn them into a delivery planes, packages flying around the world. And we went in and we sat down with this very strange man who was doing this. He needed about $12 million. And we talked, and he very had a white beard, steely blue eyes, and he was smoking a cigar. And he had all these manuals and all these applications just stacked all around to get FAA approval of it. And we talked with him. He told us the whole plan. He had all the paperwork in order for the FAA. And he said, it's $12 million. And we said, okay, we're going to bring together, you'll sign a commitment with us that we'll raise $16 million. They said, well, I don't need that. I need to, well, yeah, we know, because we are going to get $4 million for ourselves. 25% brokering commission. We'll pull the money together for you. We got the rich people to do it. We'll put it together for you, but you're going to commit to $16 million in debt to us, and you'll have your $12 million. Well, of course, we knew what was going to happen next. He said, absolutely not. Are you out of your minds? And so we thanked him, and we got up, and we left the trailer, walked out. Now, one of the three of us, a young, very handsome, very bright young man, he walked a little bit behind the other two of us. We were almost to our sedan, and he was lagging behind, and of course, the next thing was the guy came running out and caught Dan, the guy in back, and they talked, and we just stood there looking really irritated, you know, playing with the keys, looking at our watches. And so then he comes up to us, and he's yelling, guys, let's be good about this. Come on. And we're looking really irritated. It's a good act. And he says, we got him at 15. Good. And so we signed the deal at 15. You understand what we did? It was all set up. We knew he was going to reject it, and we were just going to walk out, and he knew that we were the last hope he had. And so we were going to be really nice to him. Instead of $4 million, it was going to be $3 million. It worked out okay. Unfortunately, the whole deal fell through because the FAA rejected his plans because it seems that he had been caught bringing pot into the country in the 1982 in a DC-3, and he was caught on a landing strip in Louisiana with bales of pot, which he said that he was transporting because he was a mule for the CIA, which was providing buying the pot to get weapons to move to the Sandinista guerrillas in Nicaragua in exchange for the pot going to the dealers in the United States through channels in Iran where the weapons would come from. Of course, no one believed him. It was just hilarious. He went to jail for about 5 years. Then, of course, Iran-Contra happened, and the exact thing he was describing was what was happening in Iran-Contra. Weapons for trade, for pot, weapons, Iran, lots of pot stoners here in the United States, weapons for the right-wing guerrillas who were killing the leftist government people in Nicaragua and Guatemala and places like that. So the whole deal fell through, and he was very bitter about it and all that, so we lost our $3 million. But that gives you an idea. Somewhere in that story, that gives you an idea that the price that the company bears can be considerably, that the company gains can be considerably less than what the current market price of the stock is. This happened with Staples. There's a famous reorg firm that took Staples, reorged the company, closed down a bunch of stores, knocked out all the suppliers in the United States, moved all the manufacturing over to China, the suppliers over to China, and in exchange for putting the company about $2 billion in debt. The company got about $1.5 billion. The other $500 million went to the consulting group that did this. Now, I'm making up the numbers as I go along. There was something like that. That consulting group, you might recognize one of the heads of that consulting group, Mitt Romney. And that's what they do. They set up reorgs, and they just put as part of the cost of the consulting fees that the company bears, they just fold that into the debt that the company takes on, or the stock that the company takes on. But anyway, internally generated equity is technically cheaper. So if you were doing these calculations for live fire, if it's externally generated equity, you would want to subtract off the flotation cost from the price per share. Usually you'll do a percentage, like take away 10% of the price. And that's 8% to 10%. That's a fair deal on it. Now, one other thing about this. Interestingly enough, the cost of, you notice that I'm not talking about preferred and the same thing. Well, there's preferred that's out there, and then you could sell preferred. I don't do that for debt. There's nothing about that in debt. The reason is this. Preferred and debt, the flotation cost is actually very small for those. It's almost like the investment houses do those for minimal fees usually. It's with equity that they whack this. The price that the company gets for each share that it sells is a lot less than the market price of the stock. Okay? There's one other thing too about common stock. New equity versus existing equity. A company goes out and sells stock. Okay. That means that right away, the supply of that stock goes up in the marketplace. If the supply of anything goes up, what should happen to its price? Goes down. So actually, in practice, externally generated equity has two things that will suppress the price zero. The price zero will probably be lower if there is a new sale of stock, as well as with that flotation cost. That makes new equity an extraordinarily expensive little son of a bitch. That's one of the reasons why companies that brag about we're going to sell stock, I'm not the only one, we take that as a bad sign. We take that as a bad sign right off the bat. That a company, why is this company selling stock? There are so many negatives on selling stock. First of all, the cost of equity is higher than the cost of debt to begin with. Second of all, you're going to make the price of the existing equity go down because the supply of it's going to go up. Okay, that's another one. Third, the company's selling stock. That always makes me suspicious. Why are you looking for new owners to share? Oh, you want to share your success with us? Never believe someone who says, I'm doing this to share my success with you. I made a fortune, so I'm going to help you make a fortune. Bullshit. That's not how the world works. Barney's dead. He's a dinosaur. He's oil in the ground, or at least an oil change, a Jiffy Lube. Don't buy that. Why are they trying to share ownership? What's wrong? That's my first reaction. Okay, now the final part of this aspect of it, and I'm going to write something here. I wrote a new way of doing this, but okay. Weight of debt and weight of equity. In the capital structure. That's why you might want to label this in your notes. First of all, the capital structure is the percentage of debt and percentage of equity that make up the company's total assets. put in plain English, there's the book version and then there's the market version. We talk about the market version. The book version is so whacked, it's ridiculous. So the capital structure, it's a combination of debt and equity that comprises the total assets. So, let me do this. And I wrote down an example so I wouldn't have to pull out my calculator here to do this. GMI debt of $80 million face is currently selling at 90%. Of par. That'll start us off. GMI Common, GMI has 10 million shares of Common with a current price of $12 per share. Now we can do the weights of the two different, now we can just do the weights of them. Look, the companies, and you would probably go through each different kind of debt one by one. I've simplified it here so there's only one kind of debt. But you'd look at the par value, you'd look at the face value, discount or premium. Here we're saying that their debt is selling at $900 right now. It's quoting at 90. So what we would want to do here is we would say, okay, now, market value of debt is going to be 90% of 80 million, which is $72 million. Market value of equity right now is 10 million shares times $12 per share, which would be 120 million. Okay, so now, so the value of the capital, the market value of the capital of GMI Capital is 72 million plus 120 million, which is 192 million. That also is the market value of the company's total assets. That's how we can back in. Regardless of what it says on the balance sheet, that is irrelevant in finance. We don't give a rat's ass if that number is 50 million or 500 million. The market value of this company's assets right now, sitting at our analytics point here in this class, is $192 million. Remember, liabilities plus that owner's equity equals total assets. We've got the total assets. The market's assessment of what this company's is worth in total right now. Okay, so now to get the weights, so the weight of debt would be 72 million over 192 million. The weight of equity in the capital structure, whoops, would be 120 million over 192 million. So the weights would be 37.5% debt and 62.5% equity. That is the capital structure of the firm. You've just gotten your first capital structure. That is capital structure. The capital structure is the weight of the debt and the weight of the equity in the company's assets, market value. Now, this is market value. You can do the book value, but who really cares about that? Now, comes the next point, though. Well, that's nice. We got the weights. Now we can go back and do something else kind of interesting. Let's say that this company's its cost of company's debt is, let's say, oh, I don't know. Let's say it's 12%. The company's cost of equity is 20%. The company's marginal tax rate is 30%. We can now get the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. The weighted average cost of capital is going to be the weight of debt times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity. That's weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. And in this case, that would be 0.375 times 12, whoops, times 12% times 1 minus 0.30 plus 0.625 times the return on equity, which is 20%, the cost of equity. There it is. Now remember, the cost of equity is kind of like saying the return on equity, but we're talking about cost. This is the company's cost of it. You say, well, the company doesn't pay its equity 20%, but that's the opportunity cost to the company of having those shareholders. So I can do this. Well, that didn't work. Okay. The calculator, doing this just real quick, and there's a point why I'm doing this, is 0.375 times 0.12 times 0.7 plus 0.625 times 0.2. So this company's weighted average cost of capital is 15.65%. Now, here's the upshot of this. That's actually kind of a high price, but there you go. And this is also, in some ways of doing financial analysis, this is a darn good place to, a darn good number to use for your discount rate for cash flow, for net present values and things like that. Using the WACC, use free cash flow from the project per year on the tops, and using the 1 plus the WACC on the bottom. So in other words, one way that you could see an analysis done would be for NPV to be the cost at time zero, and that would be, by the way, a negative, plus the sum from I equals 1 to n for n years of the project of the free cash flow in period I over 1 plus the weighted average cost of capital. That's one way you can do it. Not a good way to do it. There's a reason why you might not want to do it that way, but it's a way you can do it. Now, here's the thing, though. You notice that in this model, debt is cheaper than equity. We know that's the case. Believe me, I will suffer rather high credit card debt in my own company just so I don't have to share ownership with anyone, because that would be brutally expensive to me in a lot of ways, not just emotionally, but also in terms of sharing my profits if I had other owners in this company of mine. I'll take credit card debt at 16% before I would sell shares of my stock of my company out. Debt is that much more favorable than equity. Equity is expensive as hell. 20% for your existing shareholders, and north of that if you get new shareholders because of the brokerage fees to bring them in, debt is going to be a cheaper source of capital. So why the hell would any company have equity? This was a question that was posed in the 1990s by two heavies in finance. One of them, or both of them, were Nobel Prize winners, Modigliani and Miller. They you don't need to remember their names. They talk about it in the book at some point. It's called the M&M postulate or hypothesis. Companies should be 100% debt. Why would any company have equity if debt is cheaper than equity? In other words, if I were to draw a simple graphic, weighted average cost of capital on the vertical axis and percent debt in capital structure on the horizontal axis. If I were to do that, if I have 0% debt in my capital structure, then my weighted average cost of capital is nothing but my cost of equity, that high number, whatever it is, expensive money. If my company were 100% debt, then my cost of capital would be the after-tax cost of debt, which would be way down here. So in other words, as I use more debt and less equity in my capital structure, my weighted average cost of capital goes down linearly. It goes down like a straight line. Modigliani and Miller said, why don't we see every company become 100% leveraged? If debt is cheaper than equity, which we know it is as a theoretical thing, this should happen. Why doesn't it? Well, here's why. Debt is cheaper than equity until a company starts taking on so much debt that it starts to get risky to the lenders and they start jacking up the costs, the lending rate. I've seen this in more companies. I've seen it even in my own company. Here's what happens. I cash management plan for my company back when I was young and foolish doing this. They said, all right, your first $10,000, we will charge you 12% interest. Any amount between $10,000 and $40,000, we will charge you 15%. Any amount above that, we will charge you 20%. You see, because they were figuring that as I borrowed more money, I would have more and more interest expense to pay, which would put me in a greater and greater position of possibly going bankrupt. So in other words, in the real world, in reality, what happens is that, yes, at first, debt is cheaper than equity. But if a company begins to borrow too much money, the lenders start asking for higher and higher interest rates. It's not just one R sub D. And literally, in companies I've consulted for, every time when they put forth, we want a cash management plan to borrow money as we need it through the year, they'll just simply lay out, there will be tiers of debt. You borrow up to this amount, it's this cheap price. You borrow more than that, it's this more expensive. You borrow more than that, it's this more expensive. So in reality, what happens is that the weighted average cost of capital, sooner or later, starts turning because the money that is being borrowed is creating more and more risk of default, which means that R sub D starts to go up. For a while, even though it's going up, it's still going to be cheaper than equity. But sooner or later, the cost of debt starts to skyrocket. Now, I'm going to point out something here. See this place right here? Every company has one of them. It might, the profile might look like this. It might look like this. It can be all over the place, but there's a bottoming out point where the amount of debt and equity is at its lowest. We have a name for this. This is called, right here, the optimal capital structure. Hear this well. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. Now, in this course, I don't show you how you actually calculate it. It's not that hard. It's just kind of tedious. Thank God for Excel. But it is very well known. The numbers crunchers will get you the optimal capital structure. But the company, once it knows its optimal capital structure, it will bust its extra butt cheek to hold it. I've seen many public offerings where the company simply said, we're selling this stock so that we can return to our optimal capital structure. I've seen it. In other words, a company has taken on too much debt over the years, and so now it's going to sell equity, not really because it needs money, but simply because it wants to bring its equity back up and pay off some debt with the equity to bring its it back down to its optimal capital structure. In fact, there are many times when I will look at companies, and you can too, you see a company that has almost no debt in its capital structure. You're out of your freaking minds. Borrow some money for God's sake. Because you are paying this ridiculous amount. You got maybe a little tiny bit of debt in your capital structure. And if you were to use more debt, water down that equity, you would have a lower overall cost of capital. That would be in your shareholders' interest. Because right now, your shareholders are bearing the weight of you paying an extraordinary amount for capital. All you got is equity? Well, that's an awful expensive thing. Why aren't you borrowing to pay off, or rather, why aren't you borrowing for some of your projects instead of issuing new stock all the time? There are some very big companies out there. They're doing fine now, but over the long run, you have to ask yourself, how long can they play this game where they are bearing this extraordinarily high weighted average cost of capital? Yeah, you can do that when you're growing fast You know, you grow fast, money just pouring in. But someday you're not going to grow that fast, and there you're going to be sitting with this extraordinarily high weighted average cost of capital, paying way too much for your projects. And another thing, too, is, interestingly enough, notice something. If your weighted average cost of capital is higher than it needs to be, do you see how you're going to actually be rejecting projects that you might want to actually take on? You see that? Because that discount, if you use a WAC that is high, of course, the net present values are more likely to be negative, or at least not very positive. And so you're actually going to be cutting off projects that, if you would borrow to do those projects instead of constantly using your internally generated equity and selling more stock in your company to finance projects, good God. You could actually be taking, you're turning down projects that you probably should be taking. Yeah, it'll increase your risk a little bit, but at the same time, you tell me that that risk of those projects that you might be taking on is nearly what that weighted average cost of capital is doing to your bottom line of your financial statements. It's hurting your shareholders. So that's why we care so much. And like I said, there are some bean counters, finance kinds of people who do the calculation, well, the optimal capital structure is 40% debt and 60% equity. They'll do that somewhere in the back room. But once they've done that, the rest of the people in finance and in project decision making and all that begin to key on this as being a holy grail so that we will know that whenever we do projects, we are going to finance them with 40% debt and 60% equity. What that means is this.
Let me do it this way. No. Let me do it this way. Yeah, here's, I got money. Yeah. That's Denny's.
With Grand Slams are on sale.
And Veterans Day is coming up.
Okay, so, look, let me do it with numbers that actually conform to the money. Suppose that we got debt 25% so that it works with the change in my pocket. And equity, the optimal capital structure. The optimal capital structure is 25% debt, 75% equity. You take on a new project, okay? Here's what that means in real practice, in actual life terms in a company. You're the project manager, okay? And you come to me. I'm Mr. Finance. And they say, yeah, we're underway with this project, and I'm going to need another dollar. You're going to need a dollar, huh? Yeah, need a dollar. Oh, stop it, you greedy son of a bitch. And you expect me to give you a $1 bill, okay? And I don't. I go over to this box called the debt box, and I pull out a quarter. I go over to the equity box, and I pull out 3/4, and I give them to you. You think I'm really going to put those in your hand, you greedy SOB? Okay. Now, you see, that's how they finance. You would not. What you would do is you go to the bank, you get your 25 cents for that in some kind of a, or you go to the debt fund that you've raised the capital for. But then what you first do is you use your internally generated equity, in other words, what you've earned through your earnings. And then once you burn through that, then you sell some stock to keep going with the project. But literally, you do not just grab a dollar. You hold that capital structure every last project you ever do. That's the best way to maintain the balance, is that I will, every project, in order to hold my optimal capital structure, I can't just give you money out of the till. I can't just grab money out of my revolving credit account. I have to do it in this way so that every project reflects the optimal capital structure, so the entire company reflects the optimal capital structure. You follow it? That's how it actually works. That's all I have for you today. Go home.